Mary told me that things had been much better for her since she had seen me last and that Irene had remembered more than she did of what I had said on that occasion. Mary was spending her nights in her old home with her mother and sister, but did not remember much of what took place. I gave her as many hints as I could, taking my own case as a guide. I told her if at any time in the future she wished for my help, she was to think strongly about me, and would endeavor to respond. Charles's only comment on the incident was that Mary was a very pretty girl. He suggested putting in the rest of the night by taking me for a flip, as he had always looked forward to showing me that in one thing at least he had much more experience than I had. I agreed, whereupon he produced a thought form of a two-seater puss moth type of plane, in which he piloted me all over Australia, explaining the mechanism of the plane by the way. While I still over the continent, I felt the now familiar call, and leaving the plane in full flight found myself back in my body in Colombo. Puss Moth, P161, Chapter 11. Achaia arrived 10 minutes earlier than usual, whilst I was still finishing my breakfast. It had taken me a considerable time to type out the details of what had happened during the week, and I had not dared either to shave or have my bath before finishing that work, in case my memory of last night's activities dimmed and part of it would be lost. He did not seem to mind that I was not quite ready for him. He apologized for being early, seated himself upon the carpet in his usual place, and asked if he might read through the notes that I had made. I handed him the typed pages, which contained the details of my experiences since he had visited me on Monday last, and I asked him why he wanted to see them, adding that I was quite sure he was well aware of what I had been doing. He replied, "Yes, I have kept in touch with you, for I have been given permission to link up with you mentally during the period in which I am responsible for your tuition. After that, the link between your mental body and mine will immediately be broken, for we are not allowed to look into other people's minds, except in very special circumstances, similar to those which have applied to our association during the past 2 weeks. Every man is responsible to himself and to his Creator for what he does, and as you know, he is rewarded or has to suffer in accordance with the thoughts expressed and the deeds enacted. I asked to read through your notes because I want to know how much you remember of what you have done. Without reading your record, I do not know that." He carefully read through to the end and continued, "Your report concerning Tuesday night is quite good, for you remembered most of what took place during your visit to the Golden City. You missed out one rather important matter, however, for you have not mentioned that your guide took you to the outskirts of the city and pointed out to you a gathering that was listening to the thought form they had created, representing Christ speaking to them. Both you and Daphne listened for a short time to what was said. You remarked to your guide that all that Christ was saying had already been recorded in the different Gospels of the New Testament. That in itself should have been sufficient proof to you that it was not the great being, who was known on earth as Christ, who was speaking, but merely the expression of that founder of the Christian faith that was part of the thoughts and minds of his most faithful followers. I am sure that had Christ himself been speaking, and he does live and is still in control of the spiritual development of this planet, the impression of what he said would not so easily have been erased from your memory. Ask Daphne about the incident, when next you see her. She will certainly have remembered it. I am pleased with your description of Wednesday night's experiment, for it is better than I expected. I warned you of the difficulties you would experience in finding words to express mental activities, but I think that all who read your records will understand a little of what you have tried to describe. I am certainly satisfied that you have grasped most of what I tried to tell you in my last talk. Your peregrinations, wanderings, of last night need little comment from me. They have their value though, for you now understand that you have to consider the outlook of other people and to a great extent fit in with them, in the astral as on the physical plane. I am quite sure that your protege Mary will be calling for you again in the very near future, and I know that you will endeavor to assist her with the many problems which she will have to face. It will be excellent experience for you." Apostrophe today, in my last talk, I shall first tell you about the third death and what happens to the ego after he has dropped his remaining vehicle of consciousness, which we call the mental body, and lives for a period clothed in the only permanent vehicle he possesses, the causal body. I want you to listen very carefully to this, for many students seem to find it difficult to appreciate this information. The third death is very similar to the passing from the astral to the mental world, for the man just gradually loses consciousness and, having slipped out of the mental body, finds that he is in his causal body. The causal body is so called because it only functions on what is called the causal level, formed by the sixth and seventh spheres of the mental world. It is known as man's permanent vehicle because he has had it since he individualized out of the animal kingdom and became a separate human entity. The causal level is the natural home of the ego, and here he remains during the periods, which we call incarnations, when part of himself is manifesting at lower levels of consciousness and gaining the experiences necessary to free the ego from having to be born again and again in different physical bodies. Interpreted as what other such spiritual masters, initiated name the over-self or higher self slash and martinus over-consciousness or super-consciousness, ro. The causal body changes every life merely by the addition to it of the experience the man has accumulated during his last incarnation. For this reason we sometimes refer to it as the reservoir of knowledge. An evolved man can tap this reservoir at will and draw down to the physical level the experiences of his past lives. This enables him to avoid having to learn certain things every time he has a new physical brain, for, in itself, the brain has no memory of past experiences. For this reason, an evolved man has a great advantage over his less evolved brother, but each of us will be in the same position when we reach these stages of development. The most important lesson for us to learn is that it is only through our own efforts that progress can be made. More attention would be given to these matters, were they better understood and more generally taught by those people who profess to be helpers of mankind. Few of us are able to conceive the fact that the personality discernible at physical level is but a tiny part of the real man, the ego, yet this ego, or individuality, overshadows and guides that personality to the best of his ability, within the limits allowed by the free will which is granted to all men when they have reached the standard of the human entity. At the causal level, past, present and future are in reality one. Let me give you a physical plane example to illustrate this. Imagine for a moment a river, that twists and turns every few hundred yards. A man stationed on the deck of a river steamer, puffing its way on the journey it must accomplish, can see only that stretch of river in which the steamer is sailing at the moment. The stretch that exists beyond the bend to its rear, which it has already traversed, is unseen by him, and likewise, the course of the river beyond the curve, which the steamer is now being guided, is also unseen. Let us suppose that another man is taking the same route in a helicopter. He would see the whole course of the river in one long sweep, the parts at the rear of the steamer and the parts well ahead of its present position being equally clear to his vision. To this man, the scenery that the steamer has passed is just as visible as the scenery which meets the eyes of the passengers at the present moment, or that such people will see in the near future. To him there is no past and no future, all is indeed the present. The unevolved and the evolved man resemble the passenger on the steamer as compared to the one on the helicopter. From high up, he would see the whole course of the river in one long sweep, the parts at the rear of the steamer and the parts well ahead of its present position being equally clear to his vision. At the causal level, the ego is shown a full record of his past life in a series of pictures, rather as episodes on a film strip projector. These pictures show him exactly where he failed in his past life and where he excelled. They also show what his next life is intended to do for him and what changes in his character must be achieved before further progress can be made. The unevolved man sees all this, but owing to his limited intelligence does not grasp its significance in the way it is understood by the intellectual person. He is like the steamer passenger. On the other hand, the evolved man, Like the man traveling in the helicopter, sees immediately why he made the mistakes in his past life and not only the results of these errors. He determines that he will not fail in the same way in his next life. So the lessons he learnt from these pictures of the past life are built into the structure of his permanent atom, that reservoir of knowledge, which contains the essence of his experiences in his past lives, and when the time comes, in a future life, for him to make decisions on similar problems, the voice of conscience, which is the warning sent to him by the ego speaking from the plane on which his reservoir of knowledge exists, ensures that similar mistakes are not made a second time. He realizes why it is desirable for him to be born next time into a particular group of people or nation, because through such a birth he can obtain the environment that he needs. For this reason, there is never any lack of cooperation on his part, when he is shown his future life. He knows only too well that the life arranged for him is the one, which is best, suited to ensure his greatest progress. To attain this in the shortest possible time is what every ego desires. Although we all enjoy our time lived at the egoic level, we have to leave it again in obedience to the law of evolution. We all want to leave when our time comes, for we feel within us the desire for further expression and experience. We know that progress in our evolution can only be achieved through countless lives lived in the physical world. We realize that we cannot respond fully to the vibrations ruling at the causal level until we have evolved to a stage where it is no longer necessary for us to be reborn again. That time comes when we have learned all the lessons which life at the physical level can teach us, and then our attention is drawn to other spheres of activity, far beyond the physical or astral levels. Egos who have reached this stage of perfect manhood sometimes decide, of their own volition, to remain in touch with the lower planes of consciousness, merely because of their great love of the human race and their desire to help mankind in its evolution. It is well that there are such great souls, for otherwise the progress of humanity would be much slower than it is at present. My description of the method of descent into rebirth should now not be difficult for you to understand, if you remember my previous analogy. The naked ego must clothe himself once again, in other words obtain three new bodies through which he can function on the planes of consciousness applicable to them. The first body he must obtain is made of mental matter, his underclothes, and to achieve this he turns his attention to his permanent atom in which, as you will remember, he has retained molecules corresponding to all the spheres which exist the mental level. Taking the mental atom, he vivifies it and begins to draw around it other mental atoms from the matter, which exists at the mental level, in the same way that a crystal, dropped into a solution, will cause other crystals to form around it. The matter that is drawn round him takes the form of his last mental body, the one he dropped at the end of his sojourn at the mental level, with one small difference: it is a better mental vehicle of consciousness than the last one, because it includes in it the result of his mental efforts in his past incarnation. He returns to this new life with a mental body that contains all the knowledge which he has built up in all his past lives, but still has no knowledge at all concerning the subjects he had so far neglected to study. This shows why some men in the world differ so greatly from others. Their intellects are different because they possess different grades of mental bodies. Therefore, a man who is the possessor of a fine intellect, acquired through experience in many lives, should never take advantage of one who has less experience than himself. His task is to help, not to hinder, all his younger brothers. After creating for himself a new mental body, he goes a step further. He turns his attention to the astral atom and vivifies that. It at once gathers round itself other astral matter of exactly the same kind that he had in his last astral body, at the time when he dropped it. This means that all the emotional progress he made in his last life is included in the new astral body, his suit of clothes, which will serve him for this new existence. S166. This new body contains within it the results of the work he did during the years he lived under the astral plane conditions. For example, if he had studied music deeply, he will have an urge in his next physical life to take up music either as a profession or as a relaxation, and the development of musical talent will be very easy for him. The new astral body is much more sensitive than the old one, that is to say, it is able to register emotions more strongly than its predecessor. He must next have a physical body. His overcoat. This is acquired through the medium of being born in the normal way into a family in the world. The body is not necessarily a better type than that of the previous incarnation. Much depends on the lessons, which have to be learned in the new life, and the body given is the one needed at the moment. The first decision to be made is what changes in the character have to be accomplished. The answer to this decides various matters, the first of which is into which nation an ego will be born, for every nation has outstanding qualities. As you are British, I shall take your nation as an example of this. Devotion to duty is perhaps the most outstanding quality of the British character. If the ego coming into incarnation has, in his previous lives, refused to face up to difficulties, he might even have been so cowardly as to have committed suicide in one of his former lives. He obviously lacks the qualities that are so strongly a part of the British nation, so a life as a member of that group of families would undoubtedly build into the character of that individual what he needs at the moment, and at the end of that life his character will have altered considerably. When the nation in which the ego is to be born has been decided upon, it becomes necessary for a suitable family in that nation to be chosen. This is an intricate matter demanding much attention to detail and is one which is never left to chance. Although there might be dozens of families, which could give him the environment he needs, it might be impossible for him to be considered for many of these, because his actions in the past may have been such that he has not deserved the privilege of being born into such desirable circumstances. A family must be chosen through which he will come into contact with some of the personal links he has made in the past. Links are made through love, hate, marriage, parentage, being the father of an illegitimate child, deserting a woman in trouble and soon, and any karma made in these ways must be worked out. The question of heredity is another decision, which has to be made, and consideration is given as to whether the ego deserves health or must suffer from diseases, whether he is to be plain or handsome, the type of brain he deserves. The personal suitability of the parents receives consideration, the type of parents and the suitability of their marriage partnerships. Whether the ego is to be born to a mother who wants a child and will therefore do all in her power to give him a suitable start in life, or to parents who will treat him as a separate ego, considering his aptitudes when a child such as can be revealed by an urge to study music, which he may have acquired during his last astral visit, or to those who will frustrate him by paying no attention to such urges, and interfere with his movements even when he is grown up, or to people who will show tolerance in regard to religion or those who will not. Apostrophe these arguments having been made and a suitable astrological moment chosen. The child is born. It is now the task of the ego to overcome any obstacles of birth and environment with which he has been faced. Sometimes men who have ultimately been leaders of nations have been born into poor and frustrating homes. The man who succeeds in overcoming the obstacles put in his path will make certain of associating with a family of high principles in desirable circumstances, when his case is again considered for a further life in the physical world. Before concluding, I must touch on the vital subject of child upbringing. From what I have told you, you can realize that an ego can be much helped or hindered in his evolution by the attitude which his parents adopt to this subject. There are relatively so few people who have focused their attention upon the needs of children that it is now becoming difficult to find families suitable for the task of guiding advanced egos in their journeys. In order that you may realize the extreme importance of the upbringing of children, I shall first mention a few of the salient facts concerning human development. The development of man is divided into 7-year periods, each marked by the appearance of a new power or quality. These steps are intimately associated with the developmental activities of the ductless glands in the physical body. What is termed birth is indeed only the birth of the visible physical body, which comes to its high state of efficiency in a shorter time than do the invisible bodies of the ego. The physical fetus is enclosed in the protecting womb of the mother during gestation. In like manner, the subtle vehicles, the etheric, astral and mental bodies, of which I have endeavored to give you some small degree of understanding of, in these talks, are enclosed in protecting envelopes of ether, desire stuff and mind stuff, within the womb of the universe, or nature, until such time as they are sufficiently mature to withstand the conditions of the world. Physical development in the womb cannot be hastened so. In like manner, no attempt should be made to hasten the development of the non-physical bodies whilst still protected in the womb of nature. This must just be allowed to proceed, under suitable child guidance. Therefore, parents must be prepared to be guides, counselors and friends of their children till they reach the age of 21 years, at which time their mental bodies are in the condition to take over. Then, in order that the child may become a self-confident adult, all parental control must cease. Thereafter, a parent should only proffer advice if this is asked for, on account of his greater experience. To keep an adult attached to parental apron strings, as is frequently done on one pretext or another, unwise help, by selfish parents, is damaging to both child and parent. Apostrophe. The first three septennial periods of man's development are marked by the birth, or coming to completion, of the etheric body at the age of 7 years, the time of the second dentition, the astral or desire body at 14 years, the time of puberty, whilst the mental body which completes the man does not come into full activity till the age of 21. In the newborn child, only the negative qualities of these bodies are activated. Before it can make full use of its different vehicles, the positive qualities of each must be ripened. During the first 7 years of life, the forces operating along the negative pole of the ether are active. Thus, children of this age have clairvoyance of the same negative character as mediums. This is the reason why it is quite normal for young children to have playmates invisible to grown-ups. Later, in the same way, the forces working in the desire body give only a passive capacity for the feeling until the positive qualities develop. Although emotions are freely displayed at this time, they are of a fleeting quality, never lasting. The years between 14 and 21, when the desire nature is boisterous and uncontrolled, are perhaps the most difficult years for parents to deal with, for they must learn to practice the utmost tolerance and understanding at this time. Children are extremely sensitive to the forces working along the negative pole of the mind. This is the reason why they are so extremely imitative and teachable and must be understandingly dealt with till the positive qualities take over. As soon as this happens, the ego is ready and eager to stand alone, and must be allowed to do so. He will make mistakes. We have all done so. It is one of the most important ways in which we learn our lessons. In the early days of man's appearance on earth, he received little assistance from his parents, who themselves had insufficient experience in evolution to give help to others. But in these later days, conditions are so different that parent craft should be regarded as a science which it is necessary for all to study. The parents who practice planned parenthood and have only two or three children to care for, who have the necessary time to study and are prepared to do so, are able to equip themselves with the knowledge through which they can become suitable guides for children. Parents must realize that children are not playthings given to them to do with what they will, but they are fellow beings, who have been entrusted to their care and guidance by the powers that be. The suitability of the guidance given to these fellow beings is one of the most important tasks humanity is given to perform. Under the law of karma, parents will be held responsible for the manner in which they carry out this work, and their own journey along the evolutionary path will be hastened or retarded accordingly. All normal girls look forward to marriage, having a home of their own and children. This is good, because it is of primary importance that a small child should be reared in a household where it is loved and wanted. To be successful and efficient wives, however, girls should before marriage give attention to such subjects as household management and domestic routine, the spending of money, so as to get the best value for it, the selection, preparation and cooking of nutritious foodstuffs, they should understand the importance of sufficient rest and sleep, the benefits to be derived from fresh air and sunlight, and the importance of both physical and mental culture. But in order to be successful mothers, they require studying still more deeply, for they should begin to delve into some of the mysteries of nature. In this study, they should not be alone, for family responsibilities should be shared equally between fathers and mothers. Each has a part to play and a contribution to make in the upbringing of children. Wise parent craft can only be practiced by parents who have made at least some study of human development and who are willing to make some personal sacrifices. Adequately to perform the tasks allotted to them, parents must be prepared to teach by their own example, because there is nothing in the world so imitative as a child. In fact, imitation is its main method of growth, so they must train themselves never to do anything they would be unwilling to see copied. In the guiding of the emotional development of a child, there are two subjects which should be freely discussed in the home from the child's earliest years. One is sex and the other is religion. In their preparation for parenthood, parents will have studied biology as affecting the plant, animal and human kingdoms, hence should have no difficulty in telling quite small children the principles of reproduction of the different kingdoms, as suited to their years and understanding. For the very young, they can make up fascinating fairy stories dealing with the plant kingdom. They can show the child the pistillate flowers, which they will liken to girls, and the staminate flowers, which they will liken to boys. They can show them the pollen in the anthers of the flowers and the pollen baskets on the legs of bees. In the same way, religion can be dealt with in an ordinary manner. No child can be expected to understand the doctrines and dogmas of the different religions. The consideration of that can wait till he has reached the age of thinking for himself. Religious instruction applicable to the age we are living in, and the one soon to come, is to be found in the life and teachings of Christ during his earthly sojourn in the body of Jesus, in that of the Lord Buddha and the other founders of religions. If we all knew and appreciated nothing else, we should have splendid patterns to live up to. Therefore, let the teaching of religion to the young is that of the great dramas of the lives of these teachers' lives, which were sublime lessons of the possibilities of man. As with sex instruction, this must be presented in a form suitable to the stage of understanding of the child, from a Bible, from stories written in more simple language, and above all from parental example. S. 172. If parents know and put into practice the Sermon on the Mount, their children will exhibit those patterns of reaction to life which will serve as a solid foundation of the understanding of universal love and universal brotherhood. The parents who have acquired tolerance and understanding through schooling themselves to see through the eyes of their children, approach things from their standpoint, touch with their fingers, question with their minds, will, when their task of child education is finished, be in the very best position for getting to know themselves and for helping their fellow men tolerantly and wisely, which should be their task at this period of their own development, a task which can in its turn bring into being the positive qualities of their own spiritual makeup. I have been able to give you only a very brief outline of the importance of parental guidance and example in child education. In the time at my disposal, I am unable to go more deeply into the question of methods for such education. All I can do is to point out that the need for this has at no time been greater or more urgent than it is in the world today. If parents continue to shirk their responsibilities, if they are unwilling to sacrifice their pleasures in order to take up the task of parent graft, and if there continue to be as many broken homes as there now are, in which the love and understanding necessary for this task are no longer present, then consideration will have to be given to the question of whether upbringing of children, in age groups, in institutions by trained and understanding people, might perhaps be the wisest solution of the problem. It would seem as if this is at least a field of inquiry, which will have to be explored. Naturally, there are arguments which can be brought forward in defense of both systems. But if the considered decision is in favor of home training, then some steps must surely be taken towards fostering wise and instructed parent craft. I am satisfied that you know that we are not in the world by accident. You have realized that countless lives at the physical level are necessary if we are to gain sufficient experience to free us from the necessity of continuous births and deaths.